Welcome to The Spot, KALW's weekly space for the best in public radio podcasts and storytelling. I'm your host, Ashley Ann Krigbaum. Here on The Spot, I try my best to bring you stories from podcasts that highlight people and places you don't normally hear on national public radio shows or even here on KALW. This has made me a big fan of podcasts focused on communities that I've had very little interaction with before. Many of these podcasts are produced by journalists at NPR affiliate stations across the country and examine issues that have been difficult for me to fully comprehend as an outsider. I love the way that podcasts from other places help listeners understand issues that seem foreign to us, especially the issues that are so incredibly important to not shy away from. From St. Louis Public Radio in Missouri, the podcast We Live Here presents sticky arguments about culture and identity from their city and then take us literally into their streets to gain new perspectives from residents and scholars. In their latest episode, they dive headfirst into conversations about why, right now, Confederate monuments in America's southern states seem to be generating more news than ever before, including a discussion with one of Backstory's newest co-hosts about the stakes local governments have to consider when attempting to reshape a city's historical narrative.
Hi, everyone. It's me, Camille.
And me, Tim. And we want to start this show by taking you guys back to early spring in New Orleans. And there's a sense of tension all across the Big Easy.
Because after years of talk, the process to physically remove one of the four Confederate monuments in the city begins on April 24th.
A week later, on a Monday evening, a group protesting the monument's removal gathers at the statue of Confederate President Jefferson Davis.
They light candles, wave Confederate flags, some have assault rifles, and at about 10 p.m., a group celebrating the monument's removal make their way to the statue.
Lane Kaplan Levinson, she's a reporter with a local public radio station, WNNO, is there with her recorder. New Orleans resident Karen Alisich is watching across the street.
And it's almost like a reenactment between the North and the South. Just see who wins the second battle. Am I right?
The following Sunday, supporters and opponents meet again at the feet of Jefferson Davis's statue. Days later, workers, with their faces covered, wearing bulletproof vests and helmets, lift Davis's statue with a crane. They load it into a truck and drive away.
Take it down! Take it down! Take it down!
Work to take down the fourth and final monument, a statue of Confederate General Robert E. Lee, begins on May 19th. It had sat on its perch for 133 years.
And on this day, New Orleans Mayor Mitch Landrieu, who had called for the Confederate monument's removal 2 years earlier, stands in front of a line of cameras and national media.
These statues are not just stone and metal. They're not just innocent remembrances of a benign history. These monuments celebrate a fictional, sanitized Confederacy, ignoring the death, ignoring the enslavement, ignoring the terror that it actually stood for. And after the Civil War, these monuments were part of that terrorism, as much as burning a cross on someone's lawn. They were erected purposefully to send a strong message to all who walked in the shadows about who was still in charge in this city.
Landrieu wants to replace the monuments with fountains and American flags.
Now we're going to take you 670 miles north on the Mississippi River. After a couple of weeks, a different politician is overseeing a much less televised effort to remove a prominent Confederate monument.
Good, good. Thank you. So as I believe you all know, the city of St. Louis has reached a settlement agreement with the Missouri Civil War Museum that allows the Civil War Museum to remove the Confederate memorial in Forest Park.
This is St. Louis Mayor Lyda Crewson in the final weeks of June. She's explaining to a small group of journalists gathered at City Hall a deal officials recently struck to get rid of a 32-foot monument to slavery.
The monument in St. Louis is less prominent than those in New Orleans.
But like New Orleans, it stood in one of the city's most famous public places, Forest Park, for more than 100 years.
And it will be removed at the sole cost of the Missouri Civil War Museum, which is good news. This is an outcome that both parties wanted.
Crewson's announcement isn't full of applause lines. It doesn't spark any viral videos. And compared to scenes in New Orleans, seems kind of low-key.
But that would belie the real turmoil stirred up here and in many other communities about these public reminders of the country's racist roots and the deeper conversation some are having about history and heritage, a conversation many say is just getting started.
So, on today's show, we step back from the day-to-day dramas about the removal of Confederate symbols.
And we dig in to what might happen next. From St. Louis Public Radio and PRX, this is We Live Here, a show for people somewhere on the woke spectrum. St. Louis's Confederate Monument was built in 1914 and paid for by the Daughters of the Confederacy, and they put it in Forest Park.
As a reference point for that era, Woodrow Wilson was president and made Birth of a Nation the first film ever screened in the White House.
We're guessing many of you out there are familiar with the movie, but for those of you who aren't, it was seen as a huge technological breakthrough.
The movie also glorifies the KKK and was released at the height of the Lost Cause ideology. The Lost Cause ideology is basically a system of beliefs that the Confederacy fought the Civil War not to maintain slavery, but to protect states' rights.
Confederate monuments were an outgrowth of this. For instance, the plaque on the monument in Forest Park specifically says the war was fought to protect the independence of the states. Here's our colleague Wayne Pratt, reading part of the inscription on the monument in St. Louis.
Actuated by the purest patriotism, they performed deeds of prowess, such as thrill the heart of mankind with admiration.
And frankly, there's a lot of other language on that plaque that sounds like it came straight out of Gone with the Wind.
Yeah. But look, it's also important to remember that this was also the time of the Great Migration, when black families from the rural South traveled north in hopes of finding better opportunities.
For many observers, the timing isn't coincidental, and see the monument as a reminder to those black families who's really in charge.
The early monuments around the Confederacy really were a product of two things. One was to mark the kind of resurgence of white political power after the end of Reconstruction. And then in the early World War I and, you know, interwar period, there was also a need to really, you know, put an emphasis on the fact that white civilization was the world's dominant civilization.
So for those of you geeky podcast listeners like us, you may recognize this voice.
My name is Nathan Connolly, and I am the Herbert Baxter Adams Associate Professor at the Johns Hopkins University. I'm also co-host of the history podcast Backstory.
Backstory is like one of our favorite podcasts. We're both
about it all the time.
We're kind of obsessed with it. And if you haven't heard that show, you need to go check it out right after you're done listening to all of our shows.
Yes. But back to Connolly. He spent his career studying the 20th century with a special focus on immigration, segregation, politics, and urban history.
And he says these public efforts to assert white dominance run alongside a more basic desire. Officials in the early 20th century were obsessed with making their cities look nicer.
So they invested in parks and public places. These spaces, of course, were often only for white people, a kind of physical buffer.
And a lot of what went into these early efforts at city beautification were also deeply, deeply implicated in the history of segregation.
St. Louis's monument stood largely unquestioned for about 100 years.
Then in 2015, Dylan Roof, a 21-year-old white supremacist, killed 9 parishioners at Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church in Charleston, South Carolina. The tragedy sparked debate about monuments and flags memorializing the Confederacy.
And the Southern Poverty Law Center published a report cataloging about 1,500 Confederate symbols in public spaces across the U.S. Around this time, then St. Louis Mayor Francis Lay tasked his Director of Human Services, Eddie Roth, with studying how to handle the monument in Forest Park.
Here's Roth on St. Louis Public Radio's daily talk show, St. Louis on the Air, 2 years ago.
We're not going to open up a conversation and say, oh, well, you know, it's really something else, that this is about celebrating our heritage. It's a very pointed, political symbol, and it should be understood as that.
Former Mayor Slay said he wanted to get the job done, but he couldn't clear all the logistical hurdles.
So the responsibility shifted to his successor, Lida Crewson, who took office in April of this year.
She quickly vowed to make removing the monuments a priority.
As Crewson waded into the details, such as how to pay for the removal and what to do with the monument, the activism scene in New Orleans reached the gateway city.
A crowdfunding campaign was launched. Social media lit up with hashtags like Take It Down STL and Monumental Misrepresentation.
People gathered at the monument for rallies held over several days in May and June.
Taking matters into your own hands, Keith?
I mean, you wonder why we have so much crime and we have so much despair in the St. Louis area, but you have monuments of hatred that we have to watch every day.
I think it represents independence, and I support secession and freedom to the individual level.
I didn't think much about it, a statue in the park. All it took, though, was to talk about it with an African-American friend to kind of like, oh, yeah, hey, from that perspective, I get it, you know?
A lot of people see this as a thing of hate. I see it as a thing, as an educational tool to learn, just like the Jewish people have the Holocaust and Auschwitz. They leave it erected to remind us not to allow these atrocities to happen again.
One man, Bill Hannigan, was an almost daily presence at the monument. His family has lived across the street from the park for decades.
And I'm here to, you know, argue that this monument should not be destroyed. It's a work of art. It really is special. If it weren't so special as a work of art, I probably wouldn't come out here. But some of the solutions that have been proposed, burying it, taking a jackhammer to it, grinding the poetic inscription off the face of the monument, are really unacceptable. And they remind me of ISIS and the Taliban. And I don't want to see that in St. Louis.
Hannigan says his grandfather was on the committee that allowed the Daughters of the Confederacy to place the monuments in the park.
I think that was a very cool and classy act at that point. It was letting the Confederates have a space in the park where they could build their own monument in their own way within limits to honor their war dead and to express their view of the war. If you took down everything in St. Louis that had something to do with slavery or racism, the town would be flat. So, you know, we have to deal with our own history and learn from it.
In the end, it was the talks between the city and the Missouri Civil War Museum that counted most.
The museum actually sued the city after Crewson directed city workers to start taking the monument down.
But the sides reached a settlement a few days later.
And by the last week in June, piece by piece, the granite statue was carted away.
So just as it's important to know the context surrounding the original creation of these Confederate monuments, we wanted to know why they may be coming down now. Connolly, the history professor at Johns Hopkins and the co-host of the podcast Backstory, gave us an explanation.
Connolly says it's really a reflection of the limitations of this country's approach to race and inequality over the past 40 years.
Basically, since the 1970s, we have tried to approach, you know, the problems of racism and white supremacy and economic inequality from a kind of colorblind position, right? The idea is that you're not really supposed to really talk explicitly about race in public. You're not supposed to have institutions that consider the long historical problems of inequality going back to slavery through Jim Crow and elsewhere in the country's history. You're not really supposed to do anything that is seen as being in the interest of kind of small groups or special interests. And we're just supposed to have very general kind of cafeteria food style approaches to social policy and reform. But when you look at, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement, or if you look at, you know, so many other movements around the country, and again, a lot of this even on college campuses, you know, there's a very clear sense that, you know, the politics of diversity and inclusion have not kept there from being, you know, massive numbers of people killed by law enforcement officers. They have not dealt with the wealth gap. They have not dealt with the public housing or the public health crises in so many parts of the country. And so we need something more. We need something more explicit. We need something more historically grounded. And, you know, if we don't deal with that more forcefully, we're going to continue to have these problems.
The Confederate monument in St. Louis is gone, and as it stands, there aren't any concrete plans to put anything in its place.
In fact, if you were to go to the spot today, you'd just see a large patch of hay.
It's also unclear where the monument will end up. The settlement with the Civil War Museum, which took possession of the statue, stipulates it can't be re-erected anywhere in St. Louis City or St. Louis County.
In some respects, though the debates are fairly intense, the easy thing to do is simply to remove these memorials from the public square, to kind of forget that they were even there.
This is Joshua Inwood.
And I am an associate professor of geography and a senior research associate at the Rock Ethics Institute at Penn State University.
Now, maybe you're thinking, this is a bit weird that we have a geography professor on an episode about Confederate monuments. But as Inwood explains, geography includes a lot more than tectonic plates and rock formations.
But really what geographers are interested in, particularly human geographers are interested in, is the way in which we use and make space and the way that we come to understand the places that we live.
Earlier this year, Inwood and another professor, Derek Alderman at the University of Tennessee, penned a piece about the removal of these Confederate monuments. In it, they make the case that the controversy is an indicator of just how deeply people's sense of history and heritage is tied up in all of this.
And how society purposely elevates or silences the history and heritage of some groups over others.
And one of the ways I think that you can think about it is what W.E.B. Du Bois talks about as the psychological wage of whiteness. And what he talks about is the way that white folks, irregardless of their class position in U.S. society, gain some kind of material benefit from being in positions of power and having their stories represented in the public square in a particular kind of way.
Removing these monuments, Inwood says, challenges that narrative, and in some cases can start to reshape it. So how should a community like St. Louis be dealing with all these feelings?
Inwood argues for something called memory work,
which is a kind of purposeful engagement with the complexities of the U.S. racial landscape and legacies of racism that we have as a nation, but also the legacy of the struggle against that reality of racism.
Oh, okay, easy, easy then. I mean, the country is great at this.
Yeah, we have a huge track record. No, but really, he says a very straightforward type of memory work comes in the form of truth commissions.
You know, we tend to associate truth commissions like went on in South Africa or Guatemala as something that happens outside of the United States or something that happens internationally. There's actually been a fairly robust movement in the United States to address a lot of long-term struggle and violence in American communities through reconciliation.
One of the most famous examples, Inwood says, was in Greensboro, North Carolina, where citizens came together in the late 1990s and early 2000s to start a reconciliation process over a KKK shooting of labor activists. Their project spanned 20 years.
The work is hard, and it takes time. But Inwood says it's not impossible. In fact, we got him to break down the basic steps.
So here, dear listeners, is a quick list to get you started.
Yeah, you can think of it like the everyday citizen's guide to memory work.
Step one, get involved.
And that can mean a lot of different things. It can, of course, mean voting. Of course, it means being involved in local politics. But it also means thinking about the place that you live, thinking about how that came into being and thinking about how it works and does it work for everyone? And if it doesn't work for everyone, why is that the case?
Step two, start where you are. Though something like a truth commission can sound really grand, Inwood says the best memory work happens at the grassroots level, and it doesn't have to be that complicated.
A community mural, for example, on the side of a building, it can be arguably a form of memory work.
Step three, be accountable. What's that saying about faith without works? Well, Inwood says memory work with no follow-up has less of a chance of success. For instance, at the end of the project in North Carolina, residents there produced a document and a public marker.
And so one of the outcomes of that Greensboro reconciliation process was the establishment of a public memorial that talked about the violence that took place. And this was a space where people could come together and they could learn about their city and about their city's history. But it also was a space where survivors, where concerned community members could come and also have feel like they're part of the city's landscape.
And lastly, step four, stick it out. It may be tempting to think of memory work as a quick project, but sustained attention is the key. And he says the stakes right now in this moment are really high.
And it would be unfortunate for future generations to look back at this moment and say, once again, another generation of Americans turned away from the very hard work of coming to terms with race in America.
It's an opportunity that's popping up in cities and towns across America.
And it's led to some soul searching, even among people with a deep understanding of this nation's history around race.
This returns us to Backstory's Nathan Connolly. He says in the past couple years, some 60 Confederate monuments have been removed.
For decades, Connolly was of the opinion that instead of getting rid of monuments, they should be augmented. Basically something like placing a companion statue to a civil rights leader next to a symbol of the Confederacy.
Because it made sense to me to think about, you know, the importance of dialogue and debate and to take the opportunity about around these Confederate monuments to create further discussions around the history of racism in America.
But earlier this year, something happened to change his mind. Connolly and his fellow historians interviewed a man named Waverly Adcock.
For years, Adcock was a Civil War reenactor, playing the part of a Confederate soldier. But a few years ago, he found himself questioning the Confederate cause, and that led to some personal consequences.
Here's a clip of Adcock's interview with Ed Ayers, Connolly's co-host on the Backstory episode.
It means I have retired from reenacting. I've taken something that I've loved and done for 13 years and had to walk away from it completely. You know,
that's got to come with some sense of loss, right?
It is a huge sense of loss. It means walking away from a lot of friends and walking away from a lot of weekends spent in camaraderie with these people.
So you originally got into reenacting because you felt a connection with your ancestors. Do you feel less of a connection with them now that you've made this break?
No, I still feel a strong connection to my ancestors. I think we as human beings make a lot of mistakes. We do things that we regret, but I think sometimes we learn and we grow from these things. And I think my ancestors are just like me. I'm sure maybe they had these epiphanies at some point. Maybe some they didn't.
That they could look around, they could see the reality too.
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. I think they would probably be more proud of me for standing up for my convictions than to just go along with the crowd. Yeah.
Adcock's decision to step away from what he loved, to put personal relationships at risk, made Connolly think twice about his own stance on Confederate monuments.
And, you know, when put in those deeply personal terms, I think it really helped me to think beyond the abstraction of let's just consider what a debate in public would mean by having monuments alongside other monuments, right? And instead, it made me think, okay, what is it that people seem unwilling to let go of? And that Waverly Adcock, in this case, seemed very much willing to let go of. There are a lot of expectations that are placed on me as an African-American historian at an institution like Johns Hopkins, as a co-host of a mainstream broadcast, where I'm supposed to take and stake out the kind of middle-of-the-road position, right? In order to be considered kind of credible and sensible, you know, I shouldn't be advocating for a position that is too black and white. However, there are also moments, and this was where I really had to take a step back and think about the history of civil rights activism, black freedom struggles, radicalism and politics more generally, and say when you look over the list of amazing breakthroughs and necessary sacrifices and achievements that came by way of, you know, activism and collective, you know, struggle and sacrifice, you had to always have people who were unwilling to compromise their values, who knew what the record was, and said, you know what, I'm going to stake out an absolutist position and make someone who's more moderate take a step toward me. You know what, on this particular issue, I'm going to stake out a position that says the monuments have to come down. That the markers of Jim Crow, just like the colored-only water fountain signs, just like, you know, the bus signs, all of that stuff needs to basically come down and be put in some museum to create the space for dialogue in a way that is much more professionally contextualized and spatialized. So, you know, sequester them off somewhere to another location. But as far as being open and in the public, I think there's no place for them anymore.
You know, we talk to a lot of people who believe that this moment is a lot like other big generational shifts.
It's hard not to reach for comparisons to the civil rights movement in the 50s and 60s.
And yet still, at a time when a lot of places around the country are choosing to rid themselves of public Confederate reminders and actively confront the impact of racism and white supremacy, there also exists a backlash.
Civil rights organizations and news organizations have been tracking a rise in hate groups and incidents around the country. So it begs the question, where is all of this going?
We asked Connolly to make some predictions.
I've actually done a fair amount of thinking about the next 50 years, or, you know, even going forward. You know, after the end of Reconstruction, you had a real dark time in the country's history in terms of an uptick in political violence, in terms of, again, kind of mass disfranchisement, you know, murder. I mean, you know, by one count, 500,000 black people were killed across the South in politically motivated murders. When you have these moments of kind of backlash, which certainly happened after the loss of the Confederacy, you have to really ride out to meet it, right? You have to have a kind of forcefulness about what will and won't be accepted at the level of rhetoric, at the level of, you know, public celebration. We are going to have much greater political polarization in the early going that will hopefully lead to, you know, breakthroughs in really important ways. If you think historically about where we were before the Civil War, after the Civil War, during the Civil Rights Movement, we've come through moments of political polarization before. And I think, you know, part of what those moments do, you know, show us is that there is such a thing as, like, right or wrong as it concerns slavery. there is such a thing as right or wrong as it concerns, you know, mass incarceration. There is such a thing as right or wrong as it concerns, you know, these Confederate monuments, if I can just be very frank about it. And, you know, sometimes it takes a while for us to arrive at, you know, the right side of history.
But maybe we're not there yet, because just as we were putting the finishing touches on our episode, there were tons of stories in the news about a clash in a different city over history and heritage.
In Charlottesville, Virginia, a few dozen members of the KKK marched to a park where they were met with a few hundred anti-KKK protesters. They clashed, arrests were made, and that entire confrontation was sparked by that city's plan to remove its memorial to the Confederacy.
That episode of the podcast We Live Here was produced by Camille Stanley and Tim Lloyd at St. Louis Public Radio in Missouri and was originally released on July 11th, 2017. You can subscribe to We Live Here wherever you prefer to listen to podcasts or listen at their website, www.welivehere.show. That's it for today's episode of The Spot. You can find this episode and more at kalw.org. Look for The Spot under the Programs tab. If there's a podcast you recommend right now, let us know. Email thespot@kalw.org. I'm Ashley Ann Krigbaum, and thank you for listening. Tune in next week, same day, same time, for another episode of The Spot, only on 91.7 KALW.